This is an ABC podcast.
There was that famous moment in the life of the media mogul Kerry Packer. That time when he was playing polo and he had a massive heart attack. Packer was clinically dead for some minutes until an ambulance crew revived him with a device called a defibrillator, which administered a sudden hard jolt of electricity to his heart and got it beating again. Julia Stevens has an extremely rare heart condition that requires her to carry a defibrillator with her wherever she goes. But you don't see it when you meet her because it's under her skin. Julia didn't know she had a heart condition until one day it just stopped beating. And she was super fit at the time. Julia was a triathlete in training for national competitions. Julia's device has only ever gone off once in her chest. But when it did, she was a very long way from home. Hi, Julia.
Hi, Richard.
What do you call your defibrillator?
We call my defibrillator Fibsy. He's our friend. Yep.
Fibsy, my friend.
Yep.
What does it look like?
So it's a small metal device. It's probably quite circular. It's about 5 or 6 centimetres in diameter. And it's about 1 centimetre wide, and it's metal, effectively. That's the defibrillator component. Then there's a wire that actually leads from the top of the defibrillator through a vein into the heart, and so it has quite a long lead. And then that's basically anchored to the heart and is watching the heart at all times.
So it's a circular device, and is it flat? Is it sit flat under your skin?
Yeah, it's quite flat. When I'm sort of wearing a T-shirt or something, you can definitely see it poking out, and you can feel it and touch it. But yeah, it's about 1 centimetre or so deep.
And it has a wire. How far into the heart does it go?
So it depends on the condition that you've got. For me, it actually sits in the base of the heart. So a lot of my heart rhythms fail at the base of the heart. So it's basically sitting underneath the bottom.
Do you feel it when you're walking around?
I don't, no.
You don't? It doesn't irritate or itch or hurt or anything like that?
No, what I do find is that my body sort of tends to pull my left shoulder forward, so I get quite a lot of shoulder pain because I can't stretch my shoulders out as much as I'd like to, but other than that, it's fine.
So you don't really know it's there most?
Most of the time I don't think about it, no, to be honest. Not now. I certainly did in the early days.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Yeah.
I'd see how you could not. Mm. Does it have a battery?
There's an internal battery that does need replacing every 5 or 10 years. Yep.
And if that's going to give you the jolt you need, that must have to have a fair bit of charge in it, Julia.
I think it's a pretty powerful battery, I suspect.
Does it make you feel slightly bionic?
Little bit. When I first got it put in, I had a lot of trouble coming to terms with the fact that I had a bionic, effectively, device that was controlling the most important organ in my body. You spend a little bit of time trying to get used to the feeling of it being there and knowing that it's there and has control over you. So, yeah, that's a little bit of a mind game.
It's cyborg technology. It's like a pacemaker or a hearing aid.
Yep. It is actually a pacemaker as well, but I don't use that.
Oh, really?
Yep, comes with both. Buy one, get one free.
This might be a really dumb question, but does it interfere with your phone at all or internet or anything like that?
So anything that produces an electromagnetic field, I'm not allowed within 6 inches of it. So I'm not allowed to stand over a running car battery. When I do the groceries, I have to do the quick sprint in between the security gates because I'm not supposed to stand between the security gates. So I run over to load the groceries up and then run back to pay. So mobile phones just need to be more than 6 inches away from it.
What could go wrong with that?
So it can default back to the factory settings. So I've got mine. I do obviously quite a lot of sport still. So mine's set to go off at sort of, you know, more than 200 beats a minute and a regular. The factory default settings are something like 120 or 130 beats a minute. So, you know, next time I went for a ride or a run, might have a bit of an incident. So,
are you telling me you've got this device on a sports setting for you?
Yes. Right. I worked through it with my cardiologist. But the problem was when I first went in to get it checked, you actually do a download. And because I had so many incidences where my heart was getting above 167, which was the threshold we had it at, it's too much garbage for them to read through. So they set it higher so they could actually see what are more likely to be meaningful events rather than just every time Julia goes for a run or a ride. Yeah.
And is there like a, I don't know, some kind of interface on the surface of your skin?
No, so it's completely, my skin's there, but they can get they've got a laptop and they've got a wireless connection between the defibrillator and the laptop, and then they download all the information about what's happened over the last 6 months or whatever. And the other interesting thing they can do is wirelessly without touching me, they can increase my heart rate. So they basically check the pacing function, and to check that the wire is still connected and everything is still working, they can increase my heart rate up to 120, 130 beats a minute while you're sitting there. So you suddenly feel like you're going for a run while sitting in the chair. Without touching me at all, which is a little freaky.
Yeah, but that cool must technology. Be very strange. So you feel like your heart beating faster through someone else's work, in other words.
Yeah, yeah. So like you should do it maybe to lose weight. You could just sort of set it at 150, sit there for half an hour and then turn it off again.
Oh, really? Can I have one?
No.
You come from a diplomatic family originally.
Yeah,
you're seriously sporty at the same time. How did that fit into your life as a diplomatic kid living all over the world?
I think we were travelling more when I was younger. So it was sort of up until the age of about 10 that we were travelling around. So it was just, I didn't do any serious sport really until I sort of hit high school. So it was a little bit just, playing soccer with the local people in Indonesia or, hanging out with the locals. It wasn't the formal sporting at that age.
So anyway, you're kicking a soccer ball around the place, wherever it is you're living at the time. How did that sense start to ramp up to you becoming much more seriously sporty towards doing triathlons?
So there's an interim step, I guess. So I also did martial arts for 10 years. So I was a black belt for 4 years and trained for 10 years and was also an instructor. So I did a lot of sport through school. I was always good at sprinting. And then it wasn't until I sort of got into university, I started doing a bit more running, cycling. And then it was through a separation with a partner that I actually needed to fill my days up, frankly, to give me something to do. So a girlfriend said to me, look, let's go and have a go at this triathlon business. And I really enjoyed it. And I'm not the greatest swimmer, so I never did as well in triathlons because of the swimming leg, but in duathlons, where it's a run, cycle, run, I did a lot better. So yeah, look, just started to do it, got into it, enjoyed it. I love getting up early. I love, being out on the bike, going out for a run. So just built from there, really.
So the triathlons, that's like a 1.5 kilometre swim?
Yeah, so I did Olympic distance. So it's a 1.5k swim, a 40k bike ride, and a 10k run. My husband did Ironman triathlon, so that was much longer, but that was, I was more of an Olympic distance person than an endurance athlete.
Were you competitive with it?
Yeah, so I represented Australia at 2 world championships for my age group. So I went to the world championships for triathlon in Hawaii. I didn't do brilliantly because I'm not a great swimmer. But when I came back, I also did the duathlon world championships and came 13th. So that was pretty good for a full-time worker, full-time student, throwing it in amongst everything else.
You do these things to fill up your days when you're having a bad breakup relationship, whatever. Yeah. But once you've passed that, and what was the pleasure for you in doing that kind of intense training, that intense physical test? What was the pleasure for you?
I'm very competitive. So training to win is always sort of been what I've been about. So, every day getting up, kind of aiming towards an end goal. So I just motivate myself by, a bit of visualization of picturing what it might feel like to win or feel like to do a personal best or do really well. And just understanding that to get there, it's just a whole lot of hard work, really. meeting friends. We had friends that we trained with. That was really great. I met my now husband through triathlon. So, we had a bit of a, I was trying to impress him probably. He was my coach when I started triathlon. So we just.
I was going to say, how do you flirt while you're doing a triathlon?
It's probably a little bit of the post, you do a lot of training. You're also spending a lot of time hanging out with people afterwards. So the endorphin rush that you get when you do a big training session, then you're all sort of done it and you're sitting there stretching and having a chat and you're already in a good mood. You're effectively on a drug high because of the endorphins. So yeah, it's just a nice feeling.
Is the mental struggle harder than the physical one in terms of the need to propel yourself to keep going through pain and tiredness with
yes.
that?
Yep. I think we were doing about 14 sessions a week at the time.
What does that mean? 14 triathlon sessions?
No, 14 training sessions. Right. So you're effectively training for three sports, right? You're training for cycling, running and swimming, but also the transition between the sports. So you're effectively every morning and every night you're training for a couple of hours. By Friday, really, I always found Fridays hard to get out of bed for.
Saturdays. What do you mean? That means you're getting up, at dawn or something?
So 6 a.m. most days we were getting up.
And training for a couple of hours.
Yep.
Then doing a full day's work.
Yep.
And then training for more hours after work.
Yes. There. And I was also doing my master's at the time. So on the weekends, I was also studying as well as training. Don't ask.
What do you learn about yourself in the middle, or in your body, I suppose, in the middle of pain and exhaustion like that? So I don't know. I've never done anything like that. I get tired reading. Like here, I've got it here in front of me. Triathlon, 1.5 kilometre swim, 40 yeah. kilometre bike ride, yeah. 10 kilometre run. Yeah. Wow.
And that's not a long distance triathlon.
No, it's not. Right. Well, I just feel vaguely weary even reading that. So,
yeah. Look, I mean, you become very familiar with your body. You listen to your body. You make sure you're giving it the fuel it needs. It needs, you know, rest, it needs nutrition, it needs stretching. You need to listen to it and understand if you need to have an easy day. Even though you might have a program that says you've got to do a hard interval session, if you're not up for it, you know. You need to just be respectful of what your body can do, but also push it.
So you have this extreme awareness of what state your body is in and what it's doing, what's working right and what's not working right then at that time. Yeah. And you're probably more alert to that than most people are under those circumstances. I suppose I'm getting to a point here where does it make you feel, if you've won and you've had that lovely triumph, does it make you feel bulletproof at that moment or immortal or something briefly?
Happy. Yeah, I don't think I've ever felt immortal, but I certainly feel lifted and happy and pleased that it was all worth it. I think back to training sessions, especially in Canberra in the middle of winter and it's minus 10 apparent and I've got, you know, icicles on my eyelashes and my water bottles turning into a slushy because it's so cold, and it's hard mentally to just keep going. And so you look back at those times and you think, I was out there. I bet the people I beat maybe weren't out there that day. They didn't push through the hard stuff. So, you know, it's a happiness that it was all worth it in the end.
Had there ever been any warning signs about your heart?
In retrospect, yes, but not that we paid attention to. So when I was in year 11 or 12, I was feeling very unwell during a maths lesson, and I love maths, so that's, you know, I wasn't trying to get out of it. And I said to the teacher, look, I'm not feeling very well, I'm on it.
And what did unwell feel like? What did that mean?
Weak. Really weak, really suddenly. So it wasn't that I was, you know, having a bad day and had been feeling off all day. It was sitting there quite focused, quite concentrated, and then suddenly just, I remember standing up and saying to my teacher, I need to go to sick bay, and then I collapsed. So it was within a minute or two of feeling unwell, I was collapsed. So in hindsight, we think that was probably my first cardiac arrest. But at the time, everyone thought, you know, teenage girl fainting, she's so skinny because she does so much sport. you know, don't worry about it, she'll be fine. So I went to sick bay. I don't think my mum even picked me up from school. I basically just lay down for an hour or two and then went back to school.
And how did you feel when you woke up after that?
Fine. So the times I've had incidences with my heart, I don't feel any confusion. I don't feel physically particularly unwell. I just sort of feel okay. It's quite strange.
So tell me about the night it became very apparent that something was wrong.
Yeah. So we'd done a race in the morning. So we did a sprint distance triathlon, which is half of the distance you just talked about. So quite a short, sharp sprint. I'd come second. It was the ACT champ. So I was feeling obviously well, not having any signs of being unwell. Gone to the movies with some friends that night. And then I went to bed like normal. And I woke up needing to go to the bathroom at about 3 o'clock in the morning.
And were you feeling groggy or weary at that point? Fine, perfectly fine.
Needed to go to the toilet like usual. And I sat down on the loo and I remember thinking, I can't breathe. I couldn't get air in. And so I started sort of like deep breaths. And I think it's because my heart probably at that point had stopped. And there was no oxygen getting around my body. So my instinctive reaction was to just suck air in. I just didn't know. I just suddenly started gasping. And that's all I remember. What I've been told happened was I passed out. I hit my head on the corner of the basin. So it's quite a sharp porcelain corner. My husband woke up to me thumping onto the ground and he pulled me out, you know, turned all the lights on, pulled me out of the bedroom. He'd had first aid training and didn't think not to move me. His instinct was get her into the light. And he basically just started slapping me in the face as hard as he could, none of which I remember. And then I woke up and he sort of suddenly looked at me and said, does your face hurt? And I said, no, why? He said, I'll tell you later. Interesting. I was quite lucid. I was confused about why I was in the toilet and now I was sitting in a room with the light on with my husband on the bed, you know, looking very concerned. And I touched my head because I realised I'd hit my head and there was a lot of blood. And I said to him, oh, we should probably go to hospital and just get this stitched up, my head stitched up. So quite calmly, you know, really got my clothes, got out of my pajamas, got some clothes on, drove to the hospital.
You wanted to go to the hospital, not because you were alarmed by that feeling of whatever it was that made you suck in air, but just because of your head.
Yeah, which is a blessing in disguise that the basin was there to crack my head, because otherwise I wouldn't have probably gone to hospital. I would have thought, oh, passed out, must have had a big day, maybe I raced a bit too hard, you know, put it down to nothing. So, yeah, that's why we went in. When we sort of went to be triaged, we explained what had happened. You know, she'd gone to the bathroom, she passed out and she wants someone to look at her head. And they took me in straight away. They didn't even get my personal details, which I thought was very odd because I've, you know, never had such amazing service at emergency. You usually have to wait for a little while.
And were you thinking like, oh, they're overreacting? Yeah.
There was a lot of overreaction really? Going on in my head. Yeah. And so I went in and my husband stayed and gave them the details. And straight away they took me in and did an ECG. And I said to them, I've hit my head. And I actually said, can I have some Panadol? It's really actually getting quite sore. And they were completely ignoring the head and completely worried about the heart, which I thought was very confusing because I'm like, guys, here, head. So they did an ECG.
Electrocardiogram, which just sees how your heart is beating.
So it looks at the electrical rhythms of the heart. So it's not looking at the structure. So it's not looking at whether or not there's a blockage in an artery or anything like that. It's actually looking at the electrical rhythms. So they did an ECG and the nurse came in and she said, standard procedure, we do an ECG for everyone that passes out. You'll be out of here soon. So I said, no worries. Send the husband home. Off you go. You know, I'll be right. And then the next thing I knew was about maybe 30 minutes later, we had two porters come down and a doctor with a stretcher and a portable defibrillator. And they said, you've had a cardiac arrest. You need to go up to coronary care. And I said, you have the wrong patient. No, that's not me. I'm here for my head. It's okay. They did double check. They said, Julia Dawn Lovell. And I said, yes. And they said, no, it's definitely you. You've had an ECG. We've done an ECG. There's abnormal heart rhythms. It appears that you've had a cardiac arrest and you need to go up to coronary care. And at that point, I thought, What? Like, it just completely confused me. And I was alone. So I had, because I thought it was just a bump on my head. So they had to wheel, it was one flight of stairs. At this time, you know, I'm racing, I'm training, you know, 20 hours a week plus. I said, I'll just walk, guys. No, you must lie down on the stretcher. Anyway, so I had to get down on the stretcher and have the portable defibrillator with me and have a doctor with me the whole time and say, took me up into coronary care for the first time.
So they told you you'd have a cardiac arrest.
Yes.
Is that different from a heart attack?
Yes. So a heart attack is a blockage or something wrong with the blood going around the body. So the heart can still beat, but the blood's not getting around as efficiently as it should. A cardiac arrest is where the heart stops. So there's no blood moving around. So a heart attack, you can actually survive for quite a long period of time. A cardiac arrest, usually within sort of 2 to 3 minutes, you're not going to return to this wonderful world. So quite different.
So when you were there in the loo and you felt suddenly very short of breath and you were breathing very heavily, your heart had stopped at that point.
Yeah, for about 90 seconds.
Were you breathing really heavily because the heart wasn't carrying oxygen anymore through the blood?
Yeah.
So your body was instinctively just gasping?
Yeah. So it was attempting to get air in, you know, as quickly as it could, but it was inefficient because I only remember 3 or 4 gasps before I passed out. So, it was just trying to get oxygen, I presume, whichever way it could.
I always associate panic with the heart pounding, but your heart wasn't pounding.
No.
Is that feeling panic then, or is it a panic without a... What is that? What that feeling when you're going, something's badly gone wrong. I'm momentarily quite frightened about what's happening, but the heart isn't pounding. Is that still panic or something else?
It's none because you pass out so quickly. So because of the absolute lack of blood getting around, you just collapse. So I'm not conscious when this is happening. I don't have any recollection of it. They've got sort of traits. So what happens with the defibrillator is it's always watching my heart, and often, well, sometimes when I'm sleeping, my heart will stop just for a short 10, 15 seconds. And I've got no idea when I wake up in the morning that that's happened. And when the times when I've obviously passed out, there is no feeling of anything because you're not conscious.
You don't know it's happened. You're not feeling like something gone quiet. Like, you know, when, when you've got in the kitchen, you've got the exhaust fan running and someone turns it off and you go, there's nothing like that.
It is literally, you are just not aware of it. You're not conscious. You're just not there. So what's confusing is when you wake up and things are different. So, you know, it's a bit like going under a general anaesthetic. You go to sleep and then you wake up and you're in a different room and different circumstances, but But the difference is you weren't aware it was going to happen. So you just don't, you don't know what's happened. It's confusion because of, you know, I was fine and I felt fine and now I'm over here and my husband's really panicked and he's really worried, but I feel fine.
How did they deliver you the news about your condition?
So my cardiologist, who I still have an excellent relationship, I have a lot of respect for him, he came and saw me, and I remember distinctly there's a little courtyard at the hospital, and he sat me down in the sun and he gave me a Freddo frog. I don't know why. And he said, we think you've got this condition. We think this is what it is. We need to run a series of tests to confirm it. But in all likelihood, you're going to need a defibrillator implanted, and we probably won't let you leave hospital without one because we, you know, you could basically walk out and drop dead. And I, yeah, shock, absolute shock. Like, you sort of think when they, even when they move me from emergency up to coronary care, that they still kind of had it a bit wrong, or they're going to run the test again and there'll be something wrong with the machine, that, you know, there was an electrical interference or something. But no, it was really quite shocking, yeah.
That's interesting. You actually have a cardiac arrest and you go, oh. But then...
Whatever.
The shock is you've got this condition. Really?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
What is the condition? What's the name of the condition?
It's called long QT syndrome.
Long QT.
Yeah, it's one of a series of cardiac rhythms that is also part of... So you've heard of SIDS, which is sudden infant death syndrome. There's a thing called SADS, S-A-D-S, which is sudden arrhythmia death syndrome. So it's basically SIDS in adults. So you'll often see a soccer player suddenly drop dead for no reason. So it's that group of conditions. So it's sudden cardiac failure. And the top three symptoms are sudden death, syncope, which is fainting, or seizure. So quite serious. And in fact, when I was first told about it, and I went and looked at what the most common symptoms were, and sudden death is one of the top three. That was quite confronting as well.
How did your mum react to the news when you told her?
Oh, you know, probably, I don't know how she internally reacted, but externally it was very much about, okay, we've got a problem, we need to find a solution, we need to work out what the steps are, we need to get a plan, we just need to get on with it, organise it, and, you know, get on with life. There was no sympathy, there was no, woe is me, it's so sad, my poor baby daughter, youngest child, but none of that, just a really pragmatic, sensible approach to getting the family tested. And
how were you when you were telling your mum, though?
In our family, we tend to put on a bit of a brave face. So I was, you know, probably reasonably brave when I was telling her. I remember one day in the shower, when they were doing the tests and the diagnosis, just breaking down completely and crying and not understanding what was happening. And a lot of friends were visiting, and so they sort of kept me quite distracted. And they were doing the, you know, I can't believe this happened to you. You're so fit and healthy and this isn't, you know, right. But mum, yeah, there was never any of that with her. It was just, you know, what do we need to do? So these are the tests we need to have done. You need to go up to Sydney. You need to get this implanted. It was just a really pragmatic approach.
So what tests did they need you to do?
So they did what they call a stress test, which is basically putting you on a treadmill and seeing how high and fast you can run and how long and how your heart reacts to it. So they put me on a stress test and I maxed it out, which was very
exciting. Yeah, I was going to say.
Which they're not used to, because often cardiac patients are not always in the best health. So you sort of go through this, I think it was only about 12 or 15 minutes of sort of basically running uphill on a treadmill, and then they lie you down and they watch the way that your heart recovers. And then they did some more ECGs as well. And they also did some genetic testing where they took some blood and sent it to Italy to do some gene sequencing to see if there was basically a broken gene in my body that caused the problem, which is what it was in the end.
Had the doctors met anyone with this condition before? Is it rare, I suppose, is what I'm asking here?
It's rare, and it's often people find out they have it because someone they know dies. So when I spoke to my cardiologist, he admitted that he hadn't really met many people alive with this condition, and offered a second opinion for me to go up to Westmead, where there was a cardiologist who had dealt with some people who were alive with the condition, which I took him up on, which was and very sort of generous of him to acknowledge that it wasn't something he dealt with a lot. I did, in the years after I was diagnosed, I did quite a few, you know, public speaking events to try and raise awareness for it. And it was usually because parents had a child that had died, and they wanted to raise awareness. So sons who, they were a musician and they die in their sleep. someone from the AFP who had died in his sleep. So just trying to get awareness out. But it was always because someone had died. And that's often how people find out they have the condition.
So it has the similar effect that SIDS has on people, where you've absolutely. Got a perfectly otherwise perfectly healthy person who's just gone like that.
Yep, absolutely.
You mentioned that there's some kind of genetic malfunction, I suppose. There's something. What does that mean, and how does it have the effect that it does on you?
I've got what's called a nonsense gene, which basically means that when the gene is replicating itself, so when you create new cells, the genes replicate, and what happens is that a certain part of one gene doesn't complete. So it's like making a photocopy but only getting half the piece of paper, I suppose. And what that missing piece does is actually enable my body to process potassium properly. So what's happening is my body's not processing potassium as efficiently or as well as it can. And potassium is obviously a salt, and salt is used in electrical rhythms of the body. So same with calcium, sodium, magnesium, potassium. They're all used in the body for electrical systems. So often when you get gastro, people say, make sure you drink your electrolytes, right? So it's the same thing. You're losing the salts out of your body, which can result in problems with the electrical parts of your body, which is mainly the heart. So yeah, I just have to have a potassium rich diet, and really just, if I get gastro, I have to be extremely careful and really just take it easy and make sure I'm getting as much potassium as I can.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler, podcast, broadcast, and online.
You're saying the condition comes from a genetic abnormality, which doesn't allow you to absorb potassium or take in potassium, and that's the salt that you need to keep the whole system running. So you just got to make sure you've got enough potassium in your system. You've got to have a banana, an emergency banana on hand. Is that what it means?
I have an emergency banana in my handbag. Yes.
You have? Yep. That's just my part, but you do have an emergency banana at hand.
I do. It's actually not quite as simple as that. I mean, it is obviously an ongoing maintenance, so I can't just have a banana if I'm in trouble and it all gets cured. It's more about just ensuring that I've got a good balanced diet.
So in order to treat this condition you have, as you were advised that you would need to have this defibrillator put under the skin. What did they tell you about the operation to have that put in?
So basically what they do is they give you, when they were first putting in a general anaesthetic, they then tear the pectoral muscle, so up sort of just sitting under where your collarbone is. They basically tear that muscle, and for me, so in older patients, I'll put it under the skin because the older patients aren't doing quite as much activity and movement, but with me, because of my activity levels, they decided to put it under the muscle, so they basically rip the pectoral muscle.
Ouch!
And then insert the defibrillator and then sew it all back up and hope it heals.
What would happen if you didn't have that put in?
The defibrillator. Mm. So when I went up to Westmead and spoke to the cardiologist, they pulled out some research papers and said, look, you'll have an event every 4 years. One in every 4 years, you'll have an event. An event is a cardiac arrest, which has got a pretty low survival rate. So, every 4 years, I think, oh, I've had another whole life, I shouldn't be here. So, yeah, basically, we would have expected that at some point in that first 4 years, give or take a bit, there would have been a major cardiac event.
Given that it's passed on genetically, was there anyone in your family who was suddenly dropped dead?
My grandma. My grandmother at age, I think she was 42 or 44, walked out the front door to do the grocery shopping one day and died, dropped dead.
Just fell down dead?
Yep.
What did they put that down to at the time?
Sudden heart failure. She was on antidepressants and some drugs are known to extend the QT interval. So there's a certain set of drugs I have to avoid. And she, antidepressants and a lot of the sort of antipsychotic drugs are contributors. So she was on antidepressants and obviously just for whatever reason, that day was the day the heart decided to stop.
So with the operation under the muscle there, mm-hmm. with the battery and everything, you will need to replace the battery how often?
Every 5 to 10 years, depending on battery life, how often it goes off, all sorts of factors. So I get checked every 6 months to see how the battery's going.
To me, it sort of sounds a bit like you have this device inside you that's life-saving, but it's also got to be a bit like an unexploded bomb in some ways, because you know at any stage it might suddenly go off and you might be given this sudden jolt of electricity.
Yeah, and I think mentally that's the bit you struggle with when you first get one implanted, to be honest. A lot of, you know, it's a trust exercise. You have to trust that the cardiologists have got it right. You have to trust that this device has been designed to do the right thing. And, you know, it's very hard to go to sleep, particularly for me. My cardiac arrests occur when I'm sleeping. So trying to get myself to go to sleep for those first few months was really very challenging.
After you got your diagnosis, did it mean your kids have to be tested and other members of the family?
So the rest of my family, my siblings and my parents were tested. They just did that through an ECG and they all appeared normal except for my mother, who appears to also have a prolonged QT interval but has been asymptomatic her whole life. So she's fine. My children, when they were born, they took some cord blood and they did genetic testing to test whether or not they had the same faulty gene. The 50% chance I'd pass it on, 50% chance they'd be okay, and they're both clear. So, yay.
Is that when the story of the grandmother came up?
It was when I first, I was basically in hospital for 3 weeks at various different places. And as part of that, they'd do some genetic counselling to try and work out from a genetic point of view where this might have occurred. So they go through all of your different kind of family streams and try and identify something unusual that might have caused it. So obviously I have the condition. When they realise my mum has a prolonged QT as well, her mother then dropped dead during the grocery shopping, and her parents, so my great-grandparents, were first cousins. So it's likely that the gene mutated as part of their relationship and having children, and it's been passed down effectively down to me.
So. It must have been amazing for your mum to find that out. I mean, it must have been like a...
May have known. It's entirely possible. No one ever really talked about what happens with your great-grandparents. She may have known. I don't know.
I mean, the explanation for it. That's the thing.
Yeah.
Suddenly, this great mystery of why she dropped dead is suddenly explained.
Solved, yeah. 40 years later.
So 2013, you're 35, married, you got two kids, and you decided to go to South America.
Yeah.
What was the plan?
Oh, so I like travelling. Girlfriend said, look, her partner was planning on going over to spend a month in South America. Did I want to come? And I thought, maybe. And so I asked the husband. So my husband, the year before, had gone to the UK for a month with his parents. So we sort of do a bit of tag team parenting sometimes. And, you know, it's hard to travel with young children. So we didn't. We basically went off and had fun by ourselves. So we sort of organised a trip. We were going to hike the Inca Trail, going to the Amazon, and also spend a week at Galapagos Islands up off Ecuador. So that was the plan. It all went very well. We'd hiked the Inca Trail. I'd had no real problems. And then the day after the Inca Trail, I wasn't feeling great, had a bit of a gastro-y problem. So I took it really easy, went to bed early, was very well behaved. And then the next day, I felt quite a lot better. So we'd gone out during the day. We'd done a lot of hiking through the villages. We'd gone out for dinner that night and I went to sleep. And at about 3 o'clock in the morning, my magic hour, I was woken by, like, I thought I was being shot in the chest or something, like a really extreme, painful jolt that lasted for a few seconds.
Did you hear anything or was it just this?
No, it was silent, but terror really, really scary. And I think I knew straight away. So I sort of had a moment where I thought, oh, whoopsies, you know, fibsies gone off. And I just stayed really still because I was scared it was going to go off again. So I just waited there, you know, for a minute or two until I felt like, okay, everything's okay, checking my pulse.
Were you sharing with your friend or were you in your room alone?
No, I was 100% by myself in that room, but my friends were next door. So once I sort of felt like safe to get, I just went up and knocked on her door. And I think I was in shock. I think I was very shaky. I was crying. I was confused. I didn't know what to do. I was a long way from home. It's sort of a, you know, Cusco is at altitude. So the other problem was I was on anti-malarials in preparation for going into the Amazon, which I now realise prolonged the QT interval. So the combination of the anti-malarials, being at altitude and the gastro
means you lost potassium.
A little bit of a cocktail of, you know, errors. So yeah, look, anyway, after, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes, I went back to my room. Called my husband and told him. He obviously was very scared, confused, you know, same thing. He's on the other side of the world. He can't physically help at all.
And you're in Cusco.
Cusco, yeah. So I Googled what foods contain potassium. I just thought I have to eat something that's high in potassium. It was the only thing I could think of to do. And found out that apparently fruit and nut chocolate is really high in potassium. And that afternoon we'd gone and bought a big block of fruit and nut chocolate because we were going into the Amazon and we thought, oh, it would be a little treat. Yeah.
So it turned out to be a big treat.
I ate a block of chocolate at 3 o'clock and about 3:30 in the morning to try and get my potassium levels back up. So yeah, it looked really scary. And I tried to get back to sleep. It was very challenging. And when I woke up in the morning, there were a couple of GPs that were actually on the trek. And I had a chat to one of them and they sort of said, look, you know, there's not much they're going to be able to do in a hospital. You've got the defibrillator. So if the defibrillator, your internal one, can't fix you, not much can. And the added complexity was we were going into the Amazon jungle that morning.
You what?
And so we had to make a decision. I had to make a decision in the absence of any information from anybody about whether or not I was prepared to do that. So we're going down. It was a 4 hours. It was a bus ride and then 4 hours into a little down on a basically a river, into an eco lodge. So no electricity, no medical services, anything. So I tried to get in touch with my cardiologist and hadn't managed to get through to him. And I just made an executive decision that I was going to go into the Amazon because if something was going to go wrong, you know, I've got the defibrillator, it'll be okay.
Julia, that's mad.
Yep. In hindsight.
You'd had a cardiac arrest, yep. And you have this defibrillator. Wonderful. Yes. But you'd had a cardiac arrest, yep. But no, I'm still going to go into the Amazon.
Well, yeah. Part of me is a little bit stubborn, and I sort of thought I may never be here again. And, you know, what do you do? I'm no safer sitting in Cusco, really, than I would be in the Amazon. So I went there, and what was quite funny is I had a generator that they sort of, at the Amazon Eco Lodge, that they ran up about once a day to, you know, deal with bookings and things. And I just said to them, can I just for 1 minute borrow that and send an email to my husband? So halfway through, we were there for 4 days. So halfway through, I just wanted to email him and say, I'm okay, because there was no phone reception, no internet, nothing. It was complete dead. So all he's got was I've had a cardiac arrest, the defibrillator's gone off for the first time. I've made a decision, I'm going into the jungle. And then he wouldn't have heard from me for 4 days. And then, of course, when I returned and got back into the world of emails, my cardiologist had sent me an email saying, under no circumstances are you to go into the Amazon. But I got there and I was fine. So,
if the defibrillator has administered a charge, did that have enough charge in it for another one?
Yep. So it can go like 5 or 6 times. It's got quite a few charges in it. And then it stops.
So you actually did go to the Amazon and
yes.
And you did do all that. And when you got back, was your cardiologist furious with you?
A little bit. Yeah, look, I mean, you know, he knows me and he understands that I, you know, still live life to the fullest. I still do sport. I'm still going to go off and travel. So he understands that. The first thing he said was come back and see me as soon as you get back into the country, please, which I did. And they downloaded and they did see that obviously the heart had stopped that night. It had also actually stopped the night before when I had gastro, but it had restarted before the defibrillator needed to fire. Yeah.
So what happened when you got back?
So went to see him, spent the weekend with the kids, you know, chilling out, tired, you know, it's a long flight home, it's 36 hours to get home. And then on the Monday morning, I was driving into work thinking, well, we're all good, going to go to work and get on with life, not going to let these things hold you back. And something in my brain triggered a very heavy emotional reaction. And I remember driving, you know, the road to work and just bursting into tears and really losing it. Had to pull over, you know, settle myself down. So I decided at that point to go and see my parents, who've always been very good supports. And the difference was when I was first diagnosed, I didn't have children and now I do. And it was the having a conversation about what do I do if I die now? You know, no one depended on me before and now they do. So I drove to my dad's house and burst into tears, or continued to cry. And they sat down, they gave me a cup of tea, and Dad, they've got this beautiful, you know, back deck, and Dad sat down, he pulled out a cigarette and had a cup of tea, and, you know, calmed me down to start with was probably the biggest and most important thing. And then they just said, you need a plan. We had a will, but it was more about, you know, who's really going to look after the children, what's really going to happen, you know. So pulling together a really pragmatic view of what we had to do if I were to die. And that made me feel a lot better, and having a practical plan, you know. And so now I feel comfortable that if I die, of course, it will be horrendous, but the kids will be looked after, and that's what matters.
Is it a reaction to a kind of the lightning strike of it all, like the suddenness of it all, the transition from normal day like any other except you're going to the Amazon, lightning strikes you,
yeah.
And then the consequences?
Yeah, I think, and I'm very good at pushing things inside. So when I went off to the Amazon, I had a great time in the Amazon, you know. I had to enjoy it, you know. There was no option of sitting there and dwelling on what had happened. It was just, let's get on. This is what we planned. So really forgetting about it for sort of the best part of a week and just not pretending it didn't happen, but just not letting it stop me and, you know, pushing on the inside. And of course, when you get home, the kids are just, they're an incredible distraction, right? So you spend your whole time hugging them and you just sort of forget about what had happened. And then it wasn't until, the driving in, and it was absolutely just the crash of really what's happened and the seriousness of it. I mean, I think, you know, you can tell a story and say, oh, it was funny, we did this and I went off to the Amazon. But really, I mean, without a defibrillator, that night I died, right? Yeah. So that was the reality of it. And when that hit home and I thought, my friends could have gone in at 9 o'clock in the morning because I hadn't come to breakfast and found me dead on the bed. That's the alternative without having Fibsy, which is why Fibsy is my friend. So despite the fact it is intimidating to have it, I do get shoulder pain. At the end of the day, it's the best thing. And I'm lucky because everyone else who's got this condition usually finds out because someone they've loved dies. So, you know, yeah.
So now you've got Fibsy too.
I got Fibsy Part 2, yep.
Fibsy Part 2. And that's the new defibrillator.
That is a new
defibrillator. And having that pulled out and put back in?
Yeah, that was traumatic.
Why?
So it's quite routine to have a defibrillator replaced. So they often just sort of sedate you and put a lot of local anaesthetic in the area, take you into a sort of a lab and slice you open and, you know, usually pull out a defibrillator and stick a new one in and sew it up and away you go. But because the defibrillator was under the muscle, they basically chopped it open. They were attempting to pull it out of the pocket that had been created around the muscle. And there's a nerve that runs from sort of the base of your neck down through your shoulder to your basically fingertips called the brachial plexus. And as they were trying to pull it out, they ended up pulling over that raw nerve. So, you know, metal on nerve, and you can't anaesthetise a nerve. So there was nothing that they could do. So they were attempting to sort of pull it out over the nerve, and it was horrendously painful, and I was awake. So they did restrain me to try and get it out, but they weren't having much luck. And so they decided to try a new way by tearing, I guess, a new muscle pathway. So they ripped the pectoral muscle quite a bit to try and get it out through a new hole, and that didn't work very well. So they ended up just having to pull it over the brachial plexus for a period of about 5 or 10 minutes, which was, very painful.
Is there any connection between your condition and your triathlons? Your extreme fitness, is that bad for it or good for it?
So when they did the stress test on me, they map the heart and what the heart's sort of the electrical rhythms are looking like. And the more exercise I do, the more normal my heart looks because the QT interval shrinks. So the problem is the QT interval is normally long, but when I exercise, it actually shrinks quite a bit. So really, if I just spent the whole day running, I'd probably be okay.
Right, so it really does help then, being as fit as you are.
There are different kinds of long QT syndrome. So some of them are, sleep can be bad. Some of them, exercise can actually make it worse. So you need to understand the kind of long QT syndrome that you have and live your life accordingly. So obviously if I had the one where exercise exacerbated the problem, I wouldn't exercise.
How about your kids? Have they got it?
Nope, they're perfect. Yeah. So my daughter, they did an ECG when she was quite young and they thought it looked okay. So that was fine. My son, they did an ECG and they thought he had long QT syndrome. So they came and spent some time talking to us about what it would mean to have long QT syndrome in a baby, what they do with defibrillators, and sort of preparing us for the news that he was going to have long QT syndrome. There's no paediatric cardiologists that are in the public system based in Canberra, so they had to fax it actually over to the cardiologist in Sydney, and I think he was having a look at it, and maybe because of the granularity is much worse when something gets faxed, he probably couldn't measure it as perfectly, because when he did actually get the hard copy of it, he said, actually, no, it's all okay. But we did have one night where we thought he was going to have long QT syndrome, and that was also not a very good night.
No. What do you tell your kids about your condition?
They know I've got a heart problem. They know that it, might stop one day. They understand Fibsy and that they're not allowed to, headbutt me in my shoulder and things like that.
Oh, because that's nice.
They always want to, they fight for cuddling on the right-hand side because then they don't have to worry about accidentally headbutting me, whereas if they're on the left-hand side, they have to be a bit careful about
knocking
the device. Yeah,
you can tell
yeah.
your kids that, and they'll still do it, though, won't they?
Yeah, they do. I tend to have one on each side. But, they're really, I don't make it, my life is not about this condition. It's not about having a defibrillator. It's about getting on and, doing sport and being a good parent and having a good job and those sorts of things. So I don't think they really understand fully what I'm living with, but one day they will.
How about when you wake up each day? Do you think about it?
I say amen, hallelujah, I'm alive.
Every day?
Yep. pretty much every day. Yeah. I don't no longer am scared to go to sleep. If I'm feeling unwell, I'm very worried about sleeping. But otherwise, if I'm feeling fine, I'm over it. You know, I go to sleep. I know I'm going to wake up. But there is a little moment every morning where I think, yes, another day. It doesn't matter if it's rainy, cloudy, snowy. It doesn't matter what terrible things are happening in life. I got another day. So that's good.
Do you have that weird thought where you go, am I alive? Oh, yes, I'm alive.
Yes.
Because I wouldn't be thinking, am I alive, unless I was alive?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Really great to speak with you, Julia. Thank you for sharing your story.
That's all right.
abc.net.au/conversations is our website. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.